Can I open the floor to questions from my colleagues on the Commission? Would anyone like to kick off from down there? Tara?
Yeah, I've got some questions and some comments. So, as I understand it, put very crudely, what Martin's been saying and what Liz has been saying slightly contradict one another. So, I think we need to have a discussion about that. My other understanding is that the determinants of nutrition and of food security, however you might define it, that price is important, but it's not the only factor because people are irrational across income categories. So there are other influences, and if you take something like the decline in food waste, if you go and talk to the Waste Resources Action Programme, they will say it's all due to their campaigning on the issue, whereas some people say, well, threat of recession. So how you address that kind of thing. The third thing is how technology influences shifts in consumption, and then we're talking about things like internet shopping and how that affects access and availability. But my main point that I want to make is that good food has to be continuable, and that means it's got to be environmentally sustainable, otherwise we will run out of food, or that it will only be affordable to the very, very wealthy. And if we are going to have food that is sustainable, then it may have to be more expensive. And that needs to be factored into discussions about food poverty. So one way of responding to that is that it should that it's okay if the price of food goes up, as some of it becomes overall incomes go up, so it becomes affordable. But then you have to look at the percentage of food as a percentage of overall spending. And if we spend less on food, this is a general point, not targeted just at low-income categories, but the less we spend on food, the more we have available to spend on other goods and services which are energy-using and which will then have damaging environmental impacts, except things like education and healthcare, obviously. So we also have lots of discussions about the role of health taxes, health subsidies, environment taxes and environment subsidies. So my questions to you is, how do you address the environmental imperative on one hand and issues of equity, affordability on the other, bearing in mind that we perhaps need to have a notion of absolute caps on consumption overall?
Do you want to have a quick response? Clive?
There's a lot in that. There are some paradoxes in your question, because if you look at consumer behaviour over the last 6 or 7 years, under duress, me has become more important than you. And therefore, there are some interesting developments to the extent that, Marlon's point about well-being has actually been very robust through the recession. In all income groups, and some of the big messages about you are what you eat and healthy diets and all the rest of it are permeating the population. It is reflected in a period of austerity that we haven't seen major downtrading into ambient and frozen foods, into packaged goods, away from fresh and chilled foods. So well-being has actually remained very firm, and something is a well-placed for future. The environment got hammered consumer markets by the recession. And if you look at the consumption of organic food in the UK, it's probably come down by about 30% over the last 5 years. And the decision that the consumer makes as to whether this organically produced product merits the premium to produce that product just didn't survive. So in terms of linking the environment to food, I think that's a more difficult challenge today than it was 10 years ago, when incomes were rising and consumers were much more open to non-subjective, non-price factors. And it probably is only going to be forced through regulation, a major change linking the environment to food markets. At its most easy, it's putting 5p on a plastic bag, so that it changes behaviour. We've seen it in the Republic of Ireland, we've seen it in Northern Ireland and Scotland, but that's easy. when you want to fully allocate costs from the environment renewal into food prices, then that requires international action. It's very hard to do in a single country, and it's very regressive. So the benefit system and or the real economy have to compensate for that if you're not actually going to make food poverty worse, to my mind. So I think you've asked a very, very difficult question in terms of how you balance one priority of sustainability, which is tomorrow, with real needs, social needs of poverty today.
Can I just add in to the question that you asked about the slight contradiction in all different approaches, should we say? Can you just, when you answer, say something about where you're measuring change? Is your starting point that there's already inequality and you're just measuring it staying the same? How much? Can you just say a little bit about all that, please? Wait, I assumed you were both going to answer.
I think, actually, you just said one of the points I was going to make. There are quite marked differences in the community. It's also to do with data sets. I tried quite hard in reading the papers that you've written to find out how you got your nutritional data. And you just said that you took it from barcodes.
Yeah, so the way in which it's collected, not by us, but by the company who provided the data, is Kantar. They collect it from the product and from the products.
From barcodes. Which is not a great source of nutrition data if you're really going to be looking at the differences between groups. I mean, I think I don't want this to turn into a kind of bicker about data sets because I think that's not edifying or helpful. But it is quite difficult, as you said, to measure what people are actually eating, but to measure it reliably. The merit of the Kantar data, many merits of them, it is in using scanners that ostensibly helps with people where literacy is an issue or people don't have very much time, because those are precisely the people who tend to get left out of other kinds of national service which require people to fill in the forms, which is traditionally the way in which we've collected data about household intakes of one sort or another. My understanding of the DEFRA data sets is, and there are others in the room who will know this better than I, is that they're not using barcode data sets for nutrients. They're using referred to as mechanicalism, I mean the food table systems, which are much more comprehensive. The shift from the National Food Survey to Family Expenditure Survey, the combining of those two survey data sets about 6-7 years ago, did reduce the number of categories that were used in the data sets. So the National Food Survey had, I'm sorry, I'm getting the memory here, I wasn't going to have to talk about this, I've got a bit more up to speed, but the National Food Survey had several, I forget, but let's say for the sake of argument, 70,000 lines, 50,000 lines of foodstuffs that they recorded on. When it merged with the Family Expenditure Survey, that reduced down to about 30. Others in the room would be correct my actual figures. But the point I'm making is they didn't differentiate quite so subtly between many different commodities. Nevertheless, the data they collect means that you get a better sense, both of weight and of the actual nutrients in foodstuffs. The nutrients that are on barcodes are fairly crude, as I'm sure you would agree. They're not in detail, and they mostly don't relate to micronutrients, they relate to macronutrients, hence the data showing protein, saturated fat, and fat and sugars for different carbs. So I think there are some issues there. Nevertheless, the point that Martin's made is that he's comparing 2008 to 2014, and he's comparing different household groups, all in the same data set. So, whereas I was talking about, I didn't mention the DEFRA data because I knew others were going to be referring to the data set, so I have time in 10 minutes. But I could have talked about some of those. And they're also in the briefing paper. They do show more marked differences between social groups. So I think part of it is due to the nature of the data that's collected in terms of its nutritional reliability. The other thing that actually does slightly puzzle me is that your earlier versions of your conference, this time last year, as opposed to the one that you just presented, does actually highlight much more nutritional difference between them. And I wondered if that was because you had done more analysis in the 6 months in between, and if you could say something about that, because the point you made this time last year was that pensioner households, single-parent households, and those with young children had the largest decline in nutritional quality between 2005 to 2007 and 2010 to 2012, you've also brought it up to date, and that the decline was driven largely by a substitution towards processed sweet and savoury food and away from fruit and vegetables, which seems to be very different from what you were arguing just now.
Yeah, okay, so let me respond.
I'm not supposed to ask questions,
no,
that seems to me that's quite an important thing to clarify.
Yeah, yeah. So let me start with the first point regarding the data, because I think it's important to be clear. So the Kantar data records all grocery purchases that people make, so it's not intake data, it's purchase data. Well, as economists, when we're interested in how we use price and income, that's the key thing for it. And secondly, so there are 500,000 different products in the data that really cover all of the barcodes available in all of the various supermarkets. For products that have nutritional labelling, we have information exactly on the number of calories, saturated fat, protein, and so on, so the macronutrients in addition to salt and fibre. There are some products that don't have nutritional labelling, and we do have the same information that's used in depth for some of these tables. But one thing that's really an advantage of the Kantar data, which I'm not sure came through from the business, is that the averages used in the depth of data really mask a lot of variation. So if you look at the category butter, for instance, the depth expenditure of food survey data would say that a household with a butter product has, say, 35 grams of saturated fat per 100 grams. But in reality, there's a big distribution around that, and people, different kinds of people, buy different kinds of butter. And you really have to look at more detailed data in order to see that. So, in my view, actually, nutrition information is an advantage of the Kantar. Okay, and the second point regarding some differences in what was said in the working year and the kind of updated work. So one thing is that the changes in this overall measure of the nutritional quality of people's diet are small in both work. But admittedly, in this new work, they go up marginally, whereas what we published previously, they went down. That reflects the fact that we now have information on alcohol that we're including. So there's been quite strong switches away from alcohol, and that positively helps with index. And then a second thing is we've done a lot of work incorporating information on salt and formulation. So a different strand of my work is looking at the salt formulation that's been encouraged by the government. And in fact, that has had quite a strong impact in reducing the amount of salt that households have bought, and it turns out to be so that's moved the kind of overall measure of diet quality a little bit. But the overall conclusion, that really, if you look at that,
thanks. Who would like to? John Middleton, who came in late and was delayed. So this is John Middleton.
Can I just explore this inequalities question a bit further? The data that you've described, I mean, you've got a representative panel, haven't you? Is it possible to tease out from that how these average improvements and reductions in the calorie cost, if you like, are played out across different social groups within the panel?
Yeah, no, indeed it is, and that's, we do that to a certain extent in the work that I have very briefly summarised. And the way we do that is by looking separately by different socioeconomic groups and work status of households. So admittedly within those groups, so within a working household from socioeconomic, what we report is an average within that group. So there's still some distributional effects within the group that people focus on in this particular work, but we can do that. And the focus of the work really is about how things have changed over the recession. So this point, that there are differences in nutritional quality of grocery baskets between these groups, that is true, and that's evident in the data. So the point in this work is more looking at how things have changed over this time, like the more properties. And in some respects, things don't seem to have got that much worse, but there's a different question about exploring differences in the socioeconomic rating and diet, which I agree is important, and this work is not looking.
But it would be fairly fundamental to the work of the Commission to have access to those differences across social groups, because on the one level that you've presented, it's encouraging that the quality of overall diet has held up, but an average diet is not what people have, is it? And that's actually the essence of what the Commission needs to look at.
The question is, can you make that data available, do you think, to the Commission?
The data are obtained under a contract with the Kantar, means that we're unfortunately not able to take the data from IFS, so we have to work with IFS, and we can't make it publicly available, unfortunately.
Right, thank you. I know you want to say more, Tara, but are there other members first who'd like to ask questions before I come to you?
Can I respond to the second
question? Yeah.
Just very briefly. I mean, and again, this is not my expertise, but as you will know, the group at Loughborough who do a minimum income standards that was more sustainable, tried to look at environmental sustainability issues. Sustainability has many components, but looking at environmental issues. What was interesting is that from my memory is that the minimum income standard overall doesn't change hugely, but it relies on some fairly heroic assumptions about the amount of insulation in a house, and all of that. But in terms of the food budget, what was very critical was how food was cooked, as well as the more obvious thing about how much meat is in the product. And the most energy wasteful way of cooking is to have things either roasting for a long time or boiling and pan with the lid off. And the most energy efficient is to use a microwave. And in fact, if you look at a lot of the practices in really low income households, most of them is cooked using a microwave. But it's very often processed food that's been reheated. Because that's a much more, people perceive that, probably rightly, as a more financially economic way of getting a meal, because they haven't got to do major cooking, they don't have to have equipment which they don't possess, they just need whatever it is, and they put it in like kids' stuff or something like that. They just put it in the microwave, which you do use in the microwave. The point I'm making is that people do use microwaves. I know that at the time, they worked a lot with colleagues at Surrey, and we know very well, and they were quite surprised at the difference in the use of a microwave made, but continued most use of a microwave made to the fuel budget, which is not quite a food budget, but obviously it's replaced the church. I don't think there's anything like enough information at the moment to really make the kinds of recommendations and regulatory looking for,
which is a bit of an indictment. Right. I've got Andrew and then John, and I've got a question from Jeanette that I'll put and then come to you, Tara. That's all right. Andrew?
Can I first of all thank all three presenters. They've really a wealth of material there, which is going to be extremely helpful to us in grappling with this. Hard to know quite where to come in. If Tara hadn't done it, I think I would have started on the sustainability. I very much agree with the point Clive made that sort of in the jargon, internalising the externalities of food production will be regressive if we try to cost in water, biodiversity and so on. But I think, again, that reveals for me one of the things that came out of all three presentations are some of the paradoxes that are evident in the problems we're trying to examine. And one for me, which I think came out quite strongly and did surprise me, even as somebody who's worked with and in the industry, is the enormous variability for the same sorts of foods in different sorts of shops in different parts of the country and so on. And I'd just be genuinely interested what you think the explanation is for people paying more for something they could get cheaper somewhere else. Is this an information thing? Is it actually an access thing? Is it that the shops aren't there? Is it the travel thing? When you take bigger items of consumer expenditure, cars, washing machines, whatever, most people now will use price comparison sites, whatever, and you get the phenomenon that they'll go into a retail outlet and then look at the thing, decide whether they want it, and then go away and buy cheaper online. So people are quite sophisticated in their shopping behaviours to maximise price advantage on these bigger ticket items, and yet even within the same supermarket you can get something that's loose fresh at a particular price per kilo. You can buy it in a bag, probably more. You can buy it prepared, trimmed in a bag, even more. You can buy it in a can, probably cheaper than the fresh loose. And so even for the same thing, whether that's peas, Brussels sprouts, whatever, there's a whole range even within one outlet. So what is it that in your, you know, and if you're driven in economic circumstances, you want to minimise your food budget while still maintaining a nutritional standard, it seems that it is possible, there's quite a wide degree of flexibility there. So what is the barrier to that? Is it people not understanding unit pricing? Is it the way things, manufacturers, retailers display things? Is it physical availability in shops? What, in your view, is it all of the above? But I think that's an interesting thing, because it's not that, you know, like petrol or something, you can't get cheaper petrol, that's fairly standardised, but the range, top and bottom, for very similar, and certainly in nutritional terms, very similar foodstuffs, is quite broad.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that people would be bargain hunting within that, but then the evidence suggests that they're not doing that nearly as much as they might.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we keep answers reasonably brief?
So I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think the information requirement for doing it across your entire food basket is so much higher than doing it like by a ticket item. When you buy 40 goods in the supermarket, it simply takes a lot of time to really compute all of these things. But one thing that's evident over the recession is people can hold and fix the nutrient composition of the basket. People have started to make more use of buying things on sale, and they've switched towards buying own brand products. So there's evidence that when households are pushed, they do try to use some of these margins, and that's one of the ways they've been able to lower their per calorie spend. Whether they're still on exploiting gains from doing this, I think no doubt there are. But I think this thing about simply the information, the kind of time it takes to really compute and to kind of fully exploit all of this is high, and I think that's one of the reasons why it doesn't happen. And then there's a second issue about supermarket access. Some people have access to less retailers and retailers that possibly have higher prices. I think over time that's probably got a little bit better because there's been an increase in the coverage of the big supermarkets nationally, but again, I'm sure there are areas where it's difficult to search for kind of lower prices than they get high prices set in some small convenience stores.
Thanks. Briefly,
and I would add in, I think there are still geographic issues to do with disability. I don't mean in terms of what people know, I mean where people can travel to, how far. So that point I was trying to make was not very clearly that some low income households, in fact many low income households, have people with disabilities of one kind or another, physical disabilities. I'm not just talking about people in wheelchairs, although that is part of it, but also having to walk slowly, or people and low people who are either shopping at speed because they've got care and responsibilities and only manage to shop a short period, or they're shopping with small children, so they tend to go on the kind of standardised route just because of time. So I think there's quite a lot to do with that. I think there is a lot to do with, you could regard it as information, you could regard it as some obscuration, if you like, it was the opposite of information. I have heard time and again from people who work with low-income households, they receive funding at grassroots levels, and they do surveys when they work with them, and they have clubs, and they talk about shopping, how difficult people find it to work out unit prices and things like that, just because of the way different ways that things are sold. I often find it quite difficult. I have 3 degrees, one of which is one of my A-levels was maths, and even I find it quite hard sometimes to work out which is the best value product in terms of just, you know, carrots per pound, as it were, as never mind quality.
Is that an area of potential regulation
standardisation? I think there's something in that. A number of supermarkets do have a price per kilo, but they don't all, it's in very small print. But anyway, maybe that's something that I think there's potential, a lot of potential for confusion. So I think there are lots of challenges on time for many people. I think on the internet issue is quite interesting. I don't myself know what proportion of households, say in the bottom 5th% of income distribution, shop online. I know where I live in Oxford, there's a lot of online shoppers because I see the vans. I also know there's very big stories about that experience. And at some level, of course, if we are thinking about food not just as a fuel, but also as part of pleasure in life, then actually being able to go to markets, not only the guys going around the supermarket is a joy, but nevertheless, there are elements of bits of shopping that can happen. So I don't think internet shopping deals with all of it, but I think that would be something that you could well request to have some sense of who is doing internet shopping now, as opposed to who was doing it 5 years ago. Of course, you need to have access to a computer to be able to do it. But I don't think the income standards necessarily includes that. And that's another area where people cut back. People can't afford to run fridges. They're certainly not going to be affording to run computers, which is something else. There was another point I was going to make, but I can't remember that. So
thanks. Clive, do you have a comment? John, yeah, I know you have to go in a short while. So. Yeah. And then you can add in if that's all right.
I'm less interested, I think as Liz said at the start, about averages as about kind of differentiated experience. So I'm wondering if any of you've got either evidence you've got now or can provide us about how different households, even within social economic groups, have fared over the past few years. Some might have had incomes that have held up, others might have had big drops in income. Or big drops in spending patterns of food consumption, and that's masked by the averages.
Can I go to Clive? You can pick up the previous questions.
Trying to touch on all those. Well, first of all, paradoxically, up until 2012, people on benefits did best than everyone between 2008 and 2012. The squeezed middle in the UK were working families, and actually pretty, what one may consider quite well-off families. They saw a collapse in their incomes. Their credit cards were stopped, the limits on our credit cards reduced, mortgage equity withdrawal came to an end, loans weren't renewed, there was a collapse of credit. And that's where the change in behaviour happened in the UK. So there was no longer a stigma to shop at Aldi or Primark or Poundland. That's the big swing in behaviour. So that, up until 2012, the benefits were freezed. I think you'll find actually those on benefits saw the fastest growth in incomes. Unfortunately, it corresponded with rising food prices. In terms of the internet, I think it's irrelevant to what you guys are looking at, because 5% of the UK's food sales are online, and the average basket size is £100. The vast majority of people who do internet shopping will be pretty well. And I don't sense, the internet is empowering to consumers. All the supermarkets put their prices online, which I think is quite interesting from a competitive perspective. But one of the features I don't think has been touched on here today is that when food prices started to rise and inflation came through, the main mechanism that the big four retailers used to deliver value was promotions. And this is one of the key points why I think people today don't understand prices, because up to 40% of products in the supermarket are on promotion. And in certain categories, ambient categories, 70, 80, 90% of the products are on promotion. So what's the price? The price is buy one, get one free this week. It's in Asda next week. It's the same as we did that and that and that. So what is the unit price is very important. I think we've hit on something that I'm demonstrably look at. How do people understand price of red onions, the price of red peppers per unit, per shop. And then lastly, I mean, I would encourage you to go around the local council estates. Go to East Liverpool, go to East Hull, go to East Glasgow, go to East London, not even in East, and just see how people buy their food, because when they don't have access to superstores and a car, then it's tough. As you say, if you're a single mum, or if you're disabled, or whatever else, getting on a bus and lugging bags is pretty tough. Bus service provisions is quite rare, and it's where a supermarket opens up to you. I sense that the value of weight push is pretty standard across the UK. And to get more standardised as the big four narrow their price differentials materially on the hard discounters. But where you don't have access to that, and I think someone touched on rural areas earlier on, and peripheral council estates and inner cities, that's where I think you'll find food poverty.
On that point, can I throw into all of you the question that Jeanette raised, which was, what are the differences? Do you see differences between rural and urban issues around food and poverty, or is there no difference?
I think there are more extreme local income situations in rural areas than there are in urban areas, to the extent that the rural poverty is almost misunderstood or not known. And the access that a lot of poor people in rural areas have in terms of choice can be quite chronic. And they live side by side next to the most affluent people in the UK. So, I would suggest that's something that does need to be looked at. It's easy to look.
Okay,
I'd add
you
into that. The last work I did with you some years ago now about the decline in shops of rural areas, very marked. There's also one of the things that comes out of the CRISP work, the Centre for Social Policy and Minimum Income Standards work, is how much bus fares have gone up, and you mentioned transport. So people, obviously the majority of the population has cars, and quite a lot of the squeezed middle have cars, which they can't always afford to run. But if you're having to rely on public transport, all transport fares have gone up. And one of the reasons that in minimum income standards work, that those on old age pensions have done relatively better, a little bit like people on benefits, is because they have free transport. And that's a really important factor in the household budget. So in rural areas, not only is there an increasing dearth of shops, but and the cost of transport, but also the cost of housing is phenomenal in rural areas. The more recent work I saw about that shop, and I thought I knew about rural poverty, I was really taken aback by how difficult it is to get housing. And any, I don't even buy it, I mean renting or anything actually, you can get permission out of caravan or something, and also to be able to pay those rents. And the whole food issue is, and because one of the reasons it's indexed is a very small proportion of the population, but I think there's if you looked at peripheral estates, you find very similar factors to the I remember the other point I wanted to make is that there's a difference between showing data about how prices of the same commodities vary in different parts of the city. I just extracted a tiny bit of the Newcastle data, it's a huge, rich data source. There are many others collect similar data. The Kensington one is the cost of baskets. There's a difference between those kinds of data and the data that you're talking about, which is what people actually pay. And I think what that shows is that people are much cannier than might be surmised from the variation. Obviously, for those who can't get to different shops, can't get to where there is a big sale going on with fruit or something like that, then they're really stuck. Which is why I was picked up and I really argued for different in which groups you're talking about in which parts of the country.
Right.
I think there is a big variation.
Thanks. Neil and Tara, both say your points and then we'll get them to come back.
One of the things we already discussed in the Commission at our initial meeting was whether food poverty is a useful term, and we changed the title of the Commission to Food and Poverty. So I think the question is it a useful term, or is food poverty simply a subset of poverty? And I looked this week at the issue of fuel poverty, and actually half of people in fuel poverty are not in the poorest fifth of households, because there are other factors that impact, in that case, energy efficiency of home. So this is the kind of differentiation point, are there other factors than simply income which contribute to an experience of fuel poverty that we need to be kind of really looking out for? There are things like rural transport? Are there other geographic factors or demographic factors or other factors entirely which make the experience of food poverty not the same as just income poverty?
Tara,
kind of very similar to the point I wanted to the question I wanted to ask, but flipped from the other way. I mean, Liz has pointed out in her various definitions of food security is that that we're talking about cultural preferences as well, and the experience of poverty is to be disconnected from cultural norms and the participation in society. So if culture is such an important influence on our consumption patterns and identity and so forth, what would be interesting to look at is the extent, you know, maybe this is distorted when I talk about London here, but the big cities, you have these very diverse ethnic groups, you know, Turkish, North African, Caribbean, Polish, etc., etc. And my question is, where levels of poverty are the same, where is there positive deviance? Kind of where are people able to cope better in terms of accessing healthier, arguably sustainable diets, if you could actually look at that? And what are the other things other than income? That could be transport, it could be something like that. It could be family structures, it could be knowledge, I have no idea what it is. But isn't in order to look at how you might get, if we're sort of reducing it to prices, you don't want politicians to wriggle out of the price issue, but at the same time, it's certainly not the only determinant of our consumption patterns. And so looking at where there is positive where you can learn is another way of
I'm going to give you all three of you a comment on that. Then I've got a couple of questions, another thing to add. Then I'll open the floor briefly to everyone to make a point. We'll collect them, and if there's any points you want to pick up on, we will. We're running up against our time, but I would propose to extend till 1:45, if that's all right. I know one or two people have to leave at 12:30, but you have to leave?
I think it's 12:45.
Is 12:45 okay? Right, so we'll carry on. So do you want to take respond to those questions? Yes.
My first point is that there are at least two other groups who are currently doing work on is there such a thing as food poverty, is it helpful? There are more than two, but the two that I would particularly draw to your attention are a group funded by the Food Standards Agency in Northern Ireland, who put them in first, who are precisely asked to address that question. They're interviewing people at the moment. This work should have been finished midsummer, but the been commissioned in March and finished by midsummer. It's nothing to do with the people doing the work, it was delayed, it's because the project officer for the Sands Agency left and it's taken time to recruit someone. So I'm sorry that work isn't available yet to inform your work, but it will be available quite soon. And there's also a group based from the University of Aberdeen, led by Laura Lavis, who's doing work for Health Scotland, looking at very similar set of questions. Is there a usable definition? What are the implications of using different definitions? And they're using large data sets to try and come up with some of that. The second point, I think, is a pragmatic one. I think I don't have an answer. That's why I was slightly broken with the words at times, because I don't like just using the term food poverty, although I'm often quoted as doing so, and I get cited a lot. Likely enough, because I do use the term. I usually try and put the parentheses around it, but that's not the end of that. I think I have problems with household food security as well as a terminology, although that definition's overlap. But anyway, I'm happy to elaborate those. But labelling matters for who is responsible for doing things. At the moment, DEFRA has responsibility for household food security, and the Department of Work and Pensions has responsibility for social security system, and data on poverty come from DWP. So I think it's very important how this is labelled. And in the past, there was a big nutrition group in the Food Standards Agency which moved to the Department of Health, and it is now moved to Public Health England. Among the commissioners, people will know the implications of these moves very well. This has big implications for responsibility of who does what, whose job it is to sort this out. So I would urge you to think about that when you decide on the label.
Right.
My third point is that when I looked at the income case of lone parents, nearly 20 years ago now, it's rather depressing. I measured, rather they recorded, and thus I was able, with a colleague, to measure diets in great detail. We collected a huge amount of data on people's beliefs, practices, and blah, blah, blah. Broadly speaking, I didn't show the data today because I thought, being 20 years ago, it might not count, but actually very little has changed, particularly for lone parents. They are financially worse off now than they were then, in social security terms, and often in the job markets, and more likely to be sanctioned, etc., etc. We had a huge variety in household types, in ages, in jobs, in backgrounds, and in ethnicities and cultural practices amongst the lone parents we studied. The overriding factor every single time was how much money they had. And people who were living on income support at the time had significantly worse diets for micronutrients, not macronutrients, energy is fine, fat and the rest of it. But for micronutrients, their diets were worse than those who were not living on income support. It's quite hard to find a sample that included the latter. But if they were having money taken off their income support, which they often were at that time, for arrears for fuel or other kinds of debt, housing arrears at that time, or if they were buying goods using catalogues, so in other words, on a kind of a credit system, which is a very good way of managing your money, lots of people were commending that at the time, people who did that had even worse diets than people who were not doing that during the time that we were serving, obviously it was a cross-section survey. And that really just taught me, and I'm not a materialist entirely in my theoretical position, but it taught me for those at the lower end of the income distribution, money is the critical issue. I absolutely agree with what I was saying about the fact that a lot of people we're looking at the moment are not those who are traditionally important as the poorest, but who have many responsibilities for actually outgoings. You can't extract yourself from just like that and our phone contracts,
yeah.
Thanks,
Liz. Clive.
I'll leave it to you to work out what you're going to look at. But in terms of poverty, seems to be a reasonably common thing, and food is a big part of that. And because of well-being, then food's an essential part of that. So access to food involves public policy in terms of transport. Well-being involves public policy in terms of health, nutrition, and education. And the education of how to buy food, how to do it in a savvy way, how to use the internet, how to cook, how to use your kitchen appliances efficiently. And that's all, it's common sense to some degree, but they're all important factors in isolation that can make a big difference to people's lives and ameliorate poverty. So you have an important role in identifying what those things are and making policy recommendations.
Thank you.
I think there is a good point. I think reducing everything down to income and prices, you're going to lose some important factors that explain differences in behaviours across different types of people. I think that's this point about information, how well informed people are about what one needs to do in order to get both an affordable and a nutritious diet is an important thing to consider. And also simply differences in preferences across different kinds of households, which probably will reflect cultural factors ultimately. I think these are all areas where we can have much more evidence on, and I think they're likely to be important as well as certainly the economic kind of measures of prices and incomes. So I think that's
I can buy 3-0 machines from Pound where I am. If you're Turkish, you will use them. If you're Irish, you're not going to. Yes.
But can I add in, and the low parent study I'm talking about, I had Turkish and Irish and Black British and Black Caribbean, and it didn't matter how cleverly, how amazingly inventive people were in their cooking, and I watched them doing it quite often. Their diets were nutritionally inadequate if they didn't have enough money. All of those factors are important. If you haven't got enough money, you can't do it.
Right, thanks. I want to open the floor in a moment. I just want to add a couple of points from the chair, whether you can correct me if I'm wrong. From Liz, I thought one of the things that's important has been clear about the percentage of money people spend, and it varies enormously, and those recent figures were interesting. That is there an increasing segregation between rich and poor communities or within communities? And shame seems to affect the ability to collect data. You've made it very clear we need to think about distribution and unpack stuff, not use averages. on Clive, I think there's an issue that we need to think about, and you might want to say something. The links between UK concerns and our domestic concerns about food and poverty and the global position. The fact that there are big shifts taking place globally where poor people are making demands for things that maybe we want and use today. So there are issues there, and I'd be interested in your ideas either now or subsequently to that. So do we need to adjust as a whole to a new reality, and how does that affect the distribution issues we have here? And on Martin, and that partly links to a comment from Jeanette, when we hear of food prices and oil prices going down at the moment, but we also still see poverty and people in poverty having trouble with food still continuing and perhaps going up, what do you see as the future trends there? But there seems to be a bit of a contradiction there. So I'd be interested in comments back on those. But before you do, I'd like to open the floor to those of you who've taken the time and trouble to come. If you have something, an observation or a comment or a question, please let us know now. Say who you are. If there is something you would like to submit to the Commission subsequently, or have a discussion with Cameron, who's the researcher here, wave Cameron, so that anyone can see you didn't come, please do so afterwards. So I'll open the floor as well to people to make contributions now. And I know one or two people have to go. Yes, I know him because he's Dan Crossley from the Food Ethics Council, and I'm a member of the council. Dan. Okay, any other points from the... Yes, please.
My name's Hannah, and I'm from the University of Sheffield. Most people don't know. I thought one thing that I do research on, work with Liz several times on sort of the rise of food and food poverty as well. And something that really struck me was, and it's been talked about quite a lot subsequently, which I find very interesting, is kind of the issues that Clive raised around the structure of the retail industry. So obviously he talked quite a lot about structural determinants, and I think that is something for me that interesting. And I guess the question I had, which we sort of touched around a bit, but was whether everybody will see a tangible change in the structure of retail so that they will be benefited. So to what extent would low-income consumers in deprived areas really see a difference? Because on the one hand, you're saying that the big four are kind of will be opening less stores and things like that, but that you might get kind of smaller entrepreneurial shops in local communities. So there's a question there that really is kind of raised. And I did think, we got up very early for the food bank thing, so forgive me, my early morning brain has buzzed a few things, but I thought it was quite interesting that at the end there we're talking quite a lot about behavioural interventions, this idea of information thing, when for me the evidence that you were giving was showing how clever consumers actually were. So I think that there can be a kind of natural slide towards information-based interventions because they're kind of more tangible and quicker to insert rather than
thank you.
I just want to add the half of my
yes.
comments. And it slightly follows on from there, just about the structure of things and the recent comments from the grocery retail adjudicator about the structure of the whole industry. I mean, I'm certainly aware that if there's a pressure to keep prices down, then it leads to both pressures on quality, but also pressures on how staff are treated and so on. So there's all of that to be brought into the equation if for other reasons food prices are rising and the relationship between different parts of the industry down the supply chain.
Any more contributions from the floor? Tara? Oh, the lady over the back.
I just wanted to mention...
And who are you? Sorry.
Sorry, my name is Ruth. I'm from Oxfam, and along with the Church of England, Trust for Trust and Child Poverty Action Group, we published a report this morning, which Hannah just mentioned. And I just want to say I've got executive summaries here.
Thank you. Yes. Speak up, please, Lindsay.
My name is Lindsay Keane. I'm a bit of a, I have an interest in child poverty in particular. And one of the things, just a comment really, is to think about what we're doing around education of young people and food poverty. With the term well-being, maybe we should be looking at food well-being as opposed to food poverty as something. And the other thing that springs to mind was how we can learn from best practices in other countries on what they've done around this in policy and practice. So I would urge the Commission to look at best practices at addressing in legislation and policy and practice from individuals, organisations, charities and legislators.
And if you have any suggestions and examples of best practice, we'd be very welcome to have them from you. Thank you very much, Tara. And John, did you?
Yeah, while we have the industry experts with us. You've talked a lot about the processed food and the relationship between cutting your fuel bill and you know, getting a meal out of a processed meal, but we haven't said very much about the fast food trade. And you know, it was always, I think, the case that the cheapest way to get your calories is a bag of chips. And obviously you do away with your fuel bill in doing that, but the profusion of 99p chicken and chips and similar on the pizza front, it seems to me that would play into being the cheapest, not just a luxury end of things as you described, the affordable treats, but actually a cheap way of actually surviving. I just wondered if there was any other contributions I didn't make on that.
Tara, did you want to make a last?
I just feel that there's this sort of rather oversimplified dichotomy here between, so on the one hand, price as the structure, and on the other hand, education as the proxy for culture, when in fact I think the structures that influence our consumption are more than price, but it's not just about handy leaflets and labels. And I suppose what I think I would like this commission to look at are what the other ingredients, and they may be regulatory ingredients, that need to be in place in order to achieve healthy, nutritious and long-term sustainable diets that are accessible and can support to consume by all. And I think that, you know, the obvious one there is public procurement, but there are other things, and planning policy, but there are other things that we need to be looking at, more than just price, and much more than just education and leaflets and stuff. So,
okay, well, we offer you now the floor to come back with any final comments, and then a little announcement at the end. So I'll start with you, Clive.
Well, in terms of all the questions that have just been answered or asked, rather than comments, to be fair, I don't think we did just focus on price. I think the three papers actually did struggle with the breadth of the issues that we ought to be struggling with. In terms of the specific points, as to the extent I can remember them, on supermarkets, the big four supermarkets are going to open very few more stores, and the discounters are going to open somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 stores over the next 6 or 7 years. I think what's very significant here is they are opening space. It is the biggest structural change in the space of fresh produce that has been for years. The growth that's come from Aldi and Lidl in particular has been in fresh food. It's not selling packets of German biscuits. It's selling fresh produce, dairy products, and protein products. And so from that perspective, that's actually a thoroughly virtuous feature. And of course, the big four supermarkets are now having to respond to that. But if you look at the space within superstores, there's more space going into fresh and chilled food and less space into ambient and frozen food over the last 20 years. The convenience stores are fresh and chilled based. The amount of space given to ambient grocery and frozen food in the convenience store is tiny. So in terms of where space is going, it actually fits into a more fresh food, more well-being in terms of weather and choice for the market. However, that doesn't get around in peripheral council estates in the cities and rural areas, because most of those stores are in those areas. In terms of your cultural point, and bringing that to education and online, it's a tremendous time to be a young person and be an entrepreneur. If you want to set up a business today, because of the internet, it's really easy to do. 20, 30 years ago, you needed connections. You needed connections in the property market, you needed connections in the trade, you needed connections everywhere. First of all, if you want to set up a food store today, rents are really cheap because so many stores are closed down. You can go online and find supply, you can go online and create businesses. And I sense, you can see across the UK, particularly in London, a lot of food-based businesses are starting in the eating out trade, actually. So you're getting butchers with restaurants, you're getting bakers with delis, you're getting delis with bars, all a cacophony of entrepreneurs. They're not chains, individual entrepreneurs and the young people, particularly within ethnic groups. So the number of Polish grocers that have opened in the last 5 years, there's Lithuanian grocers, there are training grocers in Liverpool. Yeah, that's great. That's great for choice, it's great for diversity, and a lot of those people are selling fresh produce at staples. And interestingly enough, in terms of one of the biggest shifts in space in superstores in the last 6 years is Whole Foods. As ingredients have actually grown as a category, and prepared food has lost space as a category. So prepared ready meals market is not growing. The market for ingredients is growing because a lot of people are now preparing their own food. There's been a sea change in what people do with chicken bones. They boil them now. And that just represents a change of behaviour as a result of necessity. And then just in terms of eating out, it's a huge, you could have a session on eating out, and maybe you should do. And because there is from the local neighbourhood chip shop to fine dining. But what's basically happening is that in the middle and lower end, that's an expanding market. And to our minds, the UK is migrating towards an American model. You know, in America, about half of food eats outside the home. And that's happening, that's accelerated in the last 7 or 8 years in the UK. And I think you've got to go into the deep, there's devil in the detail of that. Some of that is affordable trip. You know, in a recession, a £2 cup of coffee, it could be seen to be rational economically, but cost of coffee at 20% sales growth. In a recession because it was an affordable treat. In terms of other forms of eating out, though, young people, the students, and how they eat, I think that's something you need to look at because that's probably in the chip and chicken category. And then for people, particularly those in work in the private sector coming out of recession, they are eating out more as well. So now the nutritional basis of eating out is interesting compared to what people eat in the home, and that probably does merit investigation. So a lot more people are eating out, particularly in London is the big issue here. What are they eating compared to those people that are eating out? A big structural change, calorie intake and growth of food.
Thanks. Very briefly, we'll get chucked out of this room in the not too distant future. So Liz, and then Martin.
I think all I want to say is that I would urge the Commission to perhaps think about distinguishing what might be crudely called ongoing owned food quality. Much of which is what I was talking about, I'm not saying it's absolutely fundamental, from some which is newer, not only, but some which is newer. And I'm just listening to the things that Clive was saying. When I said I wasn't going to answer the second question systematically, it's because I was thinking of some of the things that we were talking about. But I don't have the data and evidence to show that the way that you do. There's all kinds of new things going on. We haven't talked about people using charitable emergency food aid this morning, and that's a very good thing. Nevertheless, I would say that from the small amount of research that I've done myself and others in the room have done, and from the quite more substantive amount that I've read, and in visiting, listening to people talking, very few of the people who are making use of that emergency food are eating out in the ways that you're talking about, or eating out in the or going to the entrepreneurial street food markets and all the rest of it. Those are all of which are fantastic, I'm not knocking them. And I would urge the Commission, therefore, to try and distinguish that which is kind of major ongoing stuff from the new stuff. And some of the people who are finding themselves, well, food banks are people who have been struggling for many, many years and are now sinking below wage. But others are new to this struggle. I don't mean it's not, they're not very good at it, I think they are extremely good at it, but they're going down the path more quickly, selling assets, using up all of your family credit. I don't mean that in terms of formal benefit, I mean that you borrow from friends and family, time, energy, money, goods, etc. And people are getting into that distraught, distressed state much more quickly. And it just seems to me that food and poverty, or whatever you call it, the opposite of food well-being, I agree with that, is a marker of households in extreme distress. Now, maybe that will disappear a bit more as things get better. I'm not very convinced about it because of the conditions that are driving it, which I didn't talk about because I wasn't asked to talk about,
yeah.
Which are to do with low wages and poor contracts and...
We will be having sessions that will look at those.
I know you're having those things, but you've asked those questions now. Yeah. So that's the point I just want to make. That I think that the situation, I agree with those who are saying this, is complex, and it is. But I think you need to be distinguishing what are the driving forces of different conditions which are putting people into what might be labelled food poverty.
Thank you. Do you want to add anything, Mark?
Sure. So just very briefly, I think the... In many ways, the issues are very complicated, but I think in some sense they're, you can kind of simplify quite a lot. So it seems like food markets, for most people, work actually really quite well. Food in the market is relatively competitive. There's a wide offering of products, and there's different supermarkets who are, you know, often competing quite fiercely in prices. There's all of this innovation in the food market, people opening new delis, new butchers, and for many consumers, actually, notwithstanding the kind of recent increases in prices, things are not bad. But it seems like there are a substantial minority of the population who simply aren't able to access this well-functioning market. And I think the key question is why. And to me, something that I'm still not sure of is the issue of food poverty separate from the issue of simply poverty?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a manifestation of the fact that there are simply some people who, unfortunately, in society haven't got enough money to kind of engage in fully in the whole range of things that most of us are fortunate enough to do? Or is it something specific about food? And I think that's an important and interesting question.
Thanks very much. Clive, you didn't manage to talk about the links between the UK and the global. Maybe we can ask you to submit some thoughts about that afterwards. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We will be producing a paper that will draw together some of the evidence and publishing it on the website. We want this to be a transparent and open process, and if you look at it and you think, hey, there's something missing, tell us, send us it, write it for us, and let's have it. A new website will be going up. I have to say it isn't yet there because I just checked. It's called foodandpoverty.org.uk, which will be the dedicated website for this independent non-partisan commission, even though it's part of the Fabian Society. Our second hearing will be on the 9th of December, place still to be told. It will be on context and access. How habits and norms are shaped, the cultural and social dimensions of food and poverty, linking into some of the things that you've started to raise with us today. Please keep engaged throughout this process and let us have your feedback, and thank you to everybody.